We get the hour underway by welcoming into the show our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
What's up, sir?
I am, as always, a bit in awe and humbled by your productivity, but I suspect, I don't know, is there some sort of AI thing going on? Do you have a clone? What allows you to produce at the rate you have been producing of late?
My friend, if that weren't you asking me that question, I would pitch a mighty fit, because that is what people usually do focus on, productivity. Like, it's simply a matter of getting up, being the eager beaver, and going to work. And my production is in direct proportion with my ability. And it was the same for Schubert, same for Mozart, same for whomever one wishes to name. That's how it works. So the talent dictates the productivity. But for me personally, it has been a bit different at two different stretches of my career. One time was back in March of 2012 until December of that year, when I wrote 60 short stories. And that was but a fraction of what I wrote. And when I say wrote 60 short stories, I don't mean like, oh, I typed them up and there they were and they were abysmal. I wrote 60 short stories, any one of which I felt I could take off of that deck and pit it against any short story by anyone else there'd ever been. My life had fallen apart. My wife had left me. I'd had a stroke. I didn't know how much longer I was for the world. And I just wrote. And I thought that I would never return to numbers like that again, no matter whatever happened to me, good or bad, because simply nobody had ever done something like that. And if you do it once, if you were that one person, I wouldn't have thought it was reasonable to expect that that ever would have occurred again like that.
And yet it has, with a remarkable number. Look, and I joke, but not just work, but tremendously high quality work. But is this 140 stories in 16 months?
Yeah, if you take the two different periods. So if you take that first period with the 60, and you take the period from July of last year, so last summer, until today, that's 80 short stories. And that doesn't count the ones that are in progress or the one that I shared with you a while ago that I started this morning. And it's but a fraction of what I write, because most of my life is given over to begging people who hate me and want me dead in my industry, in which I'm blackballed, which is confusing. It's complicated because I publish more than everyone, too, to respond. To not wish to end my life if I have fiction in Harper's or a feature in some magazine or an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. But that's how it works, because the more I produce, the better I get, the greater my range is seen to be, the more loathed, really, I am. And it's taken a toll on me, being hated by literally thousands of people. And to be honest with you, what happened around this time last year, and maybe this would help people to learn a little something about it, I had a nervous breakdown, and nobody would really think that probably to hear me on the radio, anyone who reads my work, but I reached a point where I couldn't function. I was passing out during my days. I was vomiting constantly, crying myself to bed at night, sometimes crying literally before I came on your air. Couldn't face my email for 5-6 weeks. At the time, because it was just like having my soul raped again and again by people who wanted to end me, who wanted to make sure my books weren't reviewed, I wouldn't have money, I wouldn't be able to afford food, things of that nature. And what I could do, though, was compose. And that was something that didn't go away. So I don't think if I hadn't had that breakdown, I would have been writing like I did. And then it just became something where I was producing a work of art, more than one work of art, for the ages, every day. And again, just a small fraction of what I was doing, because there's the nonfiction, there's the op-eds, the personal essays, the blog, all the radio, the podcasts I tape, things of that nature, the novel I wrote in a week, which, when it comes out, won't be reviewed anywhere because of said blacklisting. But yeah, it ended up being over 16 months of my life with a gap in the middle. In fact, I wasn't writing a lot in the middle, but 140 stories are accounted for in 16 months, which is, it's almost depressing to me. It makes me unhappy in the sense that so much great work and is being suppressed in any single one of those stories could just throw story hands with any story there's been.
This is Bruce. One of the things that I so admire in your work, and I don't say that lightly, is that not just that you create all these great short stories, and by God you do, and as a short story writer myself, I'm always deep in envy, not just for how prolific you are, but how profound your stories are. What I'm wondering is, how do you balance? I write in a lot of nonfiction areas that are close, poetry, you know, short stories, novels. You're writing across the broadest spectrum of anybody I know. How are you able to compartmentalize that, which you have to do sometimes, I would think?
It's not hard for me to compartmentalize it. What is hard for me is dealing with the fact that people just can't accept it. And I don't know how to get them to be able to expand their minds or open their minds in ways they haven't before, that maybe the greatest fiction writer is our leading expert on film. Maybe he's the leading expert on classical music. Maybe he's the best on the radio. Maybe he's the best sports writer. Maybe that's one person. And I can say that, and I don't think it comes across as bumptious or anything, because one can go to the site and you read it, and you read any single thing there, and they're often done the same day. And you wouldn't come away thinking, you know what? I think somebody knows more about the Beatles than he does and writes on that subject better than this man. You wouldn't think that. And it's there, it's real, but it's so beyond the scope of our experiential expectations that it ends up getting glossed over. And I also end up paying a price for it by people in a horribly bigoted industry who want to think that they're the smartest person in the room. And I come along and they're not going to be able to think that. I'm going to be the shatterer of their illusions while also being a nice guy who doesn't drink, who runs up and down a monument every day so that he doesn't have a heart attack or another stroke. And all of that goes into the bile. I remember one time I went to the cardiologist, and I'm scared of doctors. I'm a hypochondriac that way. And I had all these problems with an irregular heartbeat, and I was fine. I had lowered my blood pressure to where it should have been simply by willing myself to do that and changing how I lived my life and losing a lot of weight and not drinking. And the guy was just fairly marveled by it. And I posted it on Facebook. It's one reason I'm not on Facebook. I said, I got a clean bill of health from my cardiologist. And 100 people in publishing befriended me because I wasn't that much closer to death. That's the kind of person you're often dealing with. But for me, in terms of the various subjects, I look at it all the same way. I tell stories that have different proper nouns, and they possess musicality and sound a bit sense and vice versa. But if you understand the way a hockey breakout works, you can also understand those same applied principles to a Keats sonnet as you can to a ballet, as you can to a Miles Davis second great quintet album, as you can to the way narrative function in a short story. So to me, it's always really just the same thing. I just might use a different voice or a different technique or invent a new voice or a new technique to say what I wish to say.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Absolutely love the piece that you sent earlier. In search of Travels with Sir Graham in the Land of King's Quest. And this is just such a wonderful reminiscence of childhood. It is absolutely delightful.
It's about the computer game. So people out there, it was probably a much bigger deal as a computer game to me than I would imagine a lot of people, though I could be wrong. But everybody knows the Oregon Trail, right? That's just a staple.
I love your line about Oregon Trail, that you being good at Oregon Trail was like being good at Crazy Eights.
Yeah, like there's not a lot of, I don't know, it feels pretty arbitrary and the dysentery is going to get you and maybe you'll shoot a bison or two. But then it's like when you do nail the bison, it's like it's too much to carry back your wagon. Sucks, bro. It's like, come on, man, I can't have someone else come out here and lend a hand. We can use this meat for a while. And then you go over a cliff into the river. King's Quest was this medieval, and the graphics were quite advanced for their time. It was this, came out in 1984, and you are Sir Graham. And the king, he says, we have some money problems, Sir Graham, but I've heard tell of three treasures out in the land. To go get the treasures, bring them back. I'll sell them on medieval eBay. We'll be in the clear again. It'll be awesome. The Ram, who doesn't really look like a knight, he's like this pixelated dude who, I said in the piece, looks like he should have like a piece of grass in his mouth. He's kind of a rube. And he goes out, and we used to play this game, my friends and I, in the mid-'80s when I was just a kid. And they probably thought, it's raining outside, this is what we have to do. And I thought, this is excellent. This is like, I saw a whole new world in this game. It opened up ways of thinking about narrative to me, because you could have something really realistic. And yet, it could be a story where you could tweak reality. And when you tweak reality, like in the story I showed you earlier today, it's about this woman who, she gets on her subway car every day, and there is a kid that nobody else can see on the subway car. And the word ghost is never used, but when some hefty middle-aged guy comes down and he sits down, the kid just disperses. The guy gets up and leaves, and the kid's back. The key to doing something like this is you don't explain it away. You don't say, look, this is going to be weird. I'm going to violate the rules of natural order. You are the natural order. You inhabit the rules that you're inventing, and then you just walk them through in your story. You inhabit it. You're the creator. You're the decider, so long as you never verve away from that. And that's kind of one of the things that I saw in this silly game, King's Quest, which I was also really bad at. And we had these woods behind our house. And I don't know, I just saw this connecting between this silly game and these wheels and creeks and all of that kind of medieval stuff. And what I saw when I looked out in the backyard, and I thought to myself, huh, you can bridge this, boyo. And it was important to me.
Colin, one of the things, I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm halfway through Dark March. I've been reading from each collection a little bit at a time. And I said to someone the other day, if you like Garcia Marquez and you don't have to have people explain the whole world to you, you will love this. So you're connecting that video game with that understanding of that kind of magic realism that just happens?
I am, but I don't think of Dark March as magical realism.
No, I wasn't saying that.
I feel like because to me that trends a little bit towards surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying to Rich one time, we were talking about Star Wars, which isn't really germane in some ways, Dark March, but it's a very human book, even though there are going to be animals in it, whatever. You have a coat rack. And coat rack is humanity. It's the human condition. And you put what you put on the coat rack, whether it's a low frills jacket or it's a giant snowsuit for the environs of Hoth. It is a kind of dressing, but my coat rack is what I always come back to. And I wrote that book when my own life had come apart. And it's not about me. It's not autobiographical, because I didn't live in a house where, for instance, the basement got deeper as the roof outside got lower. Like, that didn't actually happen to me. But I wrote from within that emotion. And nowhere in that book, or in Anglerfish, does the narrator, third person or first person, it's usually third person, ever say, hey, look, a little caveat here, disclaimer for you, this isn't like this. It is the reality. That reality, right, in Dark March is as real as if it's raining outside right now and I walk out there and get wet. It just exists in a different place that overlaps with our internal shared space.
Well, the story, the partial story that you sent along, the subway friend, is just, man, it pops you right in the gut. Does that have a publication date? When might people see that?
Well, I started writing it this morning.
You started that this morning?
Yeah.
I have it right in front of me. It's 3,000 words. I wrote one yesterday. I started this morning. I went and walked 3 miles, did my 5 climbs, came back, did a 45-minute podcast. That 3,000 words was about, I don't know, 70 minutes worth of work. When I was waiting to come on your air, I spell checked it. But I'll write it, and it'll be every bit as good as something like Fitty. If I had to pick one story, I think Fitty's the best story anyone's ever done. I think it would have legs to the point that it's about gun control and a woman who makes a sacrifice for a student in her class. I think it could be a story that reaches Congress, that humanizes a pandemic in a way nothing else has. But it's like, I beg these people, it's like, look, man, just please look at this, which is beneath me. But it's the situation I'm in right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, when we talk about the number of words that you produce in any given day, but I feel like probably that output is doubled if you count the number of times you're reaching out to idiots in the publishing industry.
I formally write all of the writing I do. 1% of that is formal writing. Almost all of my life is 50 letters a day, 100 letters a day. And when I had like fiction come out in Harper's, I did something. I did an experiment. It was 2018. I tried to hit everything as hard as I could possibly hit everything at once. And people in my life were like, this will be great. This will be the career maker, which it would be for somebody else. And I thought, this is going to be bad. I'm dreading this. These people are going to double down. And I had 11 pieces published in 18 days. And they were big. Feature in Rolling Stone, feature in Sports Illustrated, fiction in Harper's, op-ed in the LA Times. And they tried to end me after that. It's like, I have just not had a career. I've had 50 careers in the last 3 weeks. And it was like, we need to contain this blaze. This must not go any further. And it became harder than ever at that point. So when I have these stories, I have these 80 stories since last July. It's not like they're worse than the Harper's story. I wrote the Harper's story in a half hour after I got up. I didn't even have an idea for it. I just sat down and said, oh, here's some cold coffee. Let's write a story. That's all that was. And it just came out that way.
Wait, and you...
I have these 80 stories, and it's like, for love or money, I can't give them away for free.
And you've shared with me, and I think with Bruce as well, some of the responses you've gotten from, I mean, sometimes you don't get a response at all, but even the responses you get are about as vague and noncommittal. I mean, I want to punch those people, and I don't even have to deal with them.
We all get them.
it's a lot of times it's cloud cuckoo land. And sometimes, too, I get into somebody's wheelhouse, and they've done very little in life, and what they have in life is something that's been handed to them. And I eat their proverbial lunch before they wake up every day. And they get to have me in a position I should never be in, where they can big league me and talk down to me. And a lot of these people have their positions. It's not competence. It's just like, if you have a lot of drinks and get in your car and drive home, you might not clip a mailbox or two. That's what their jobs are like. I didn't clip a mailbox. We didn't fold today. It's not like you're the best at this. You should be having this job. You're so adroit. It's not that at all. And there's so much resentment. There's so many pieces of the pie, the ability, the production. A lot of people stare at the blank page in terror. The fact that I do this all on my own. There isn't an agent in America who will represent the guy who has been in any single magazine or newspaper you can name. And even now, with their blacklisting, I light it up. I was in the New York Daily News on Friday with a hockey op-ed, this smart set thing. It's just all the time they're going to pay that back until I get to the point, and I will, where I force hands. And that's what all of this is about right now. That's what the monument's about. People think the monument's fun. I go up and down the monument in physical training so I can keep going to beat these people.
You know, Colin, I'll tell you why I know you're going to beat him. Last year, I got a query from an editor wanting to know if I would send her a story because she had seen another story in another magazine. Well, her editorial staff, the story she admired, they rejected it. I said, no. I said, I'm not going to do it. Not for two copies of your magazine and $100. It's going to come around, and it's going to be guys like you that are better than the rest of us. They're going to change this because it can't keep going the way it's going. It won't last. It'll implode.
They've killed off reading.
Yes,
they've made it so it's like the island of misfit toys, and they've drawn a black curtain around it, and anything can happen. Send your kid there. Anything can happen to your kid. It's really bad, and nobody's looking because they've killed interest. And then it just becomes cronyism, and it becomes maintaining the fiefdom. It becomes stocking the dollhouse with the people you want in the dollhouse. Everything I do, I don't write MFA stories. I don't do anything like the way these people do. But I guarantee everyone out there listening, you read Dark March, if you read Fitty when it finally gets to come out, you read something like this new Subway story, you're going to think to yourself, not only is this awesome, but reading doesn't have to be boring. I want to do more of this. Read the blog. Struggling something in your life, anything like that. You're looking for inspiration. You're looking for a way to be honest with people or keep going or cool films to go to or whatever it might be. Sign up for the blog because I am here for you. Audience, you are the people that matter. You are the people that one writes for. It's ultimately all about you more than anything.
Well, Colin, the army of Flemingites, we may be small, but we are growing every day, and we continue to add people to it. So keep doing what you're doing, and we'll catch up with you again next week.
All right, boys. Have a good one.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown, 25 after the hour. And this piece in the Smart Set about King's Quest is just wonderful.
Yeah, you know, he is so right. It is the cronyism. It's the incestuous way that publishing is right now. A guy like Colin is surpassing in quality and in volume, you know, the Stegners and the Cheevers and many of the greatest guys going. But because there's this incredible prejudice against people that don't fall into a certain group of categories
right.
now.
And then they want to be able to put you in a box and say, well, this is what you do. You write about this.
Yeah, and I'm always, you know how much I love hockey. I'm always impressed when I read anything by Colin about hockey, and I think to myself, how can he be so much better at this than I am? He's, I mean, he's young enough to be my son. I get that, but the his range, he's the ultimate five-tool player.
Yeah, you know? There's no question.
He can really do it all.